This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, is Al Berman. Al is the president of Jefferson Solutions. He's a former administrator for federal procurement policy at the Office of Management and Budget. And he is currently, or recently, was named the chairman of the Procurement Roundtable. Al, great to have you here.
Thanks, Roger. Very nice to see you.
It's been a while, but I'm looking forward to the show. We're just going to talk about the general state of procurement, where things are going, and just your views based on your long experience in the field. Al, first, just let's talk about the Procurement Roundtable. As I mentioned, you took that over in as chairman. In January of this year. Can you tell us a little about the Procurement Roundtable and what it does?
Sure. I was very pleased to be elected chairman of the group. The prior chairman was Bill Tuttle, who was an Army general, head of LMI subsequently, and our first chairman was Elmer Stotz, who was a former Comptroller General of the United States and a very distinguished figure.
Yeah, I know that name.
In public service, and Elmer is a chairman emeritus, so... And the roundtable was set up in 1984. It's made up of 50 senior individuals, most of whom have had roles that have been pretty important roles in the procurement process in a number of federal agencies. And we have also academics. We have people from law firms in town. We have people who are working with large contractors who are providing support to the government. But many of them have been undersecretaries or senior procurement executives at agencies or people who have had roles in procurement in a variety of different kinds of agency settings. And the purpose of the roundtable was to take the expertise and the experience of these folks who are now out of the government and who are serving on a pro bono basis and let them see what they can do to try to help the government procurement process run more effectively, be more efficient, be more economical. And we produce white papers that address those kinds of issues. We meet regularly on a monthly basis and have speakers come in. Those speakers are people who are practitioners and are well known in the process. When I was my first meeting in January, I had Peter Levine, counsel to Senator Levin on the Senate Armed Services Committee and an old friend. And it's an opportunity to have a give and take and to have people who've been there in government and know those kinds of issues and then can bring some of their private sector experience to bear as well.
Sure. So, it sounds like a great, sort of forum for raising just what are the challenges, because it is a community. It's both government and industry, it seems to me. That's my experience, having been now on both sides. It's a community. And there's common cross-cutting concerns that both affect industry and government, and the opportunity for a group like that to get together and talk about those issues, try to figure out, potential suggestions for solutions, I think is a good thing. What is the roundtable sort of looking at right now in terms of what are you guys are sort of focusing on?
Well, I think the issues that many people in government worry about are the same ones that the roundtable worries about, and that's the whole question about the strength of the workforce and the adequacy of the workforce to be able to do the job it's supposed to be doing. And of course, we've seen over the last decade or so a huge growth in funding, and when you take a look at the people that are performing that role, there hasn't been that same kind of huge growth in numbers. And it's something, Roger, that you and I both dealt with when we were on the SARA panel together, the same kind of concern. Are there ways to try to ensure that you have a very professional workforce to try to make sure the government gets the best deal possible in its contracting?
Yeah, well, why don't we stay on that subject? It's a great subject, the acquisition workforce. From your perspective, what do you think right now are the key challenges facing the workforce? I think you started to touch on the volume of work versus the resources available. Is that still the fundamental challenge, you think?
I think that's still a fundamental challenge, although we are seeing that the numbers are going up. People are recognizing the need, and it was nice to see that it was happening both in the administration and on the Hill, that there was kind of a universal sense that this was an issue and something needed to be done about it. So that is a very positive thing. The kinds of problems you run into, of course, is like in many other parts of government, you have an aging workforce. So you're going to be getting a whole bunch of retirements pretty soon. And the topic itself is a little esoteric. I mean, it requires a lot of skills to be able to do this well, and business skills, but also understanding how government works. And government is different from the private sector and how it does its business. And so finding
No matter what they say about commercial item contracting, it is still different,
It's still different. Under any circumstance, it's still something, a different beast. And so people have to learn it and understand how to do it. And you've got a limited number of people at higher levels who do that. And so the kinds of problems you run into is, one agency robbing another agency of their senior people with promotions, but you don't have a lot of people at those senior levels who can fill these slots. And so I'd say one of the real challenges for agencies these days are recognizing they need to get people and develop them and being able to train them, being able to give them the skill sets and bringing them in at a very junior level and giving them that kind of an experience.
Yeah, and I guess just following that up, it seems to me that senior leadership now, when we're in this era of budget cuts and the stress on the budget and, in talks of, how to reduce government spending, I still see the acquisition workforce as an investment worth making. Ultimately, the return on that investment means better procurements, better value for the taxpayer. And this may be obvious, but, in terms of a senior leadership, the commitment has to be there, regardless of, how agencies are restructured to make that investment, don't you think?
I absolutely agree, Roger, but you do wonder, given what's likely to be happening to the budgets over the next few years, how agency leadership, how they're going to make these kinds of decisions. I know when I was talking to Paul Dennett when he was in the procurement job a few years back, and I think there was a recognition there that more people were needed, went to the agencies and said, give me your numbers. How many people do you need? The numbers that came in, very small, and very small because agency leadership had to weigh getting these kinds of folks versus all of the other mission-critical folks that they need to run their agency. And often when you get faced with that kind of decision, the support group tends to lose out.
Sure.
And particularly if people see this as not a professional function critical to the strategic mission of the agency, but as an administrative function, that people are basically just signing documents and putting documents out, but they're not really making the agency run.
Yeah, and we both know it is not. I mean, at its best and for most services acquisitions, it is not an administrative function. You're talking about sophisticated buying that's done in terms of support services and just general, information technology. Just what DOD buys every day in terms of support for the warfighter. We're talking about sophisticated business decisions that have to be made. It's not an administrative function. So hopefully things like, acquisition workforce training funds, I think, to try to sort of put, fences around that funding, that to me is an approach that that hopefully the government continues to take.
And one of the things that I've seen is it does seem like agencies recognize the need to provide that training, and that money tends to be available. We do a lot of work in a lot of different agencies, and agencies want to send these people to training to get them trained to do the job.
Yeah, with that, that's an area where I think collaboration with the private sector has to continue in terms of like whether it's a procurement roundtable and sharing best practices or new ideas, the idea of collaborating with the private sector to try to figure out the best way to do things and actually deliver training and improve the process is something I think needs to continue.
I agree. I think it should be a high priority. The problem is that ordinarily, having spent many years in government, when this crunch time comes, some of the first things that tend to go are those sorts of needs.
Training. Right. I think it, because it's viewed as overhead, right?
It's viewed as overhead or something that you can get away with without having to worry so much. You're not firing people.
Right.
And obviously, most agencies are going to do their best to try to protect their people. So you do the travel and you do the training and you do the kinds of things where you think that you can get away with it. And in my view, that'd be a bad decision for this community.
Well, here, you know, we do have to worry about our budget right now, too. So we have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more with Al Berman, and we've been talking about the general state of procurement, the acquisition workforce. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Throughout the history of American defense, Northrop Grumman has helped give the men and women of our military an edge with innovative design. Northrop Grumman delivered the products and systems that changed the course of battles and of wars. Today, our technology makes a difference in every domain. Air, land, sea, space, and cyberspace. The people of Northrop Grumman build satellites, unmanned systems, electronic systems, information technology, as well as submarines and ships. We build the systems that give our troops a moment-by-moment picture of the battle space and a critical war-fighting advantage, along with shields from enemy threats. For 70 years, wherever the American military has served, Northrop Grumman has supported our nation's and our allies' defenses with the most advanced technology. Northrop Grumman, defining the future.
The FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com takes a look at the issues surrounding cloud computing through the eyes of those who are using it every day. We'll share with you the challenges, opportunities, and lessons learned from some of the top minds in the world of federal IT. Collaborate with others and help shape the discussion on cloud computing at the FedCloud blog on federalnewsradio.com or follow the FedCloud blog on Twitter. The FedCloud blog is sponsored by Cisco and Intel.
Next week, tune in to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Conversation with Authors, exploring power, security, and leadership in the 21st century. For the United States to be an effective world leader, how must it balance all three aspects of its power? Defense, diplomacy, and development. What are the strategic threats facing the U.S. today? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with General Tony Zinni, former commander of U.S. Central Command and author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
With vacation time just around the corner, are you ready to go? Since 1967, Ackerman Security Systems has been keeping families like yours safe and secure. For just $18.95 a month, you can trust in the protection of Ackerman's nationally certified monitoring center. And Ackerman offers the latest technology, like cell phone control, wireless monitoring, and remote video to your web-enabled phone, iPad, or laptop. Call 888-999-1070 or on the web at AckermanSecurity.com.
The website of the week is the Google Transparency Report. Now, this site includes an interactive map, so you can click on different countries. The Chinese officials consider censorship demands to be state secrets, so we cannot disclose that information at this time. This can show traffic patterns. If a country blocks internet access, you can immediately see this. You can see if any countries are blocking internet traffic. The Google Transparency Report.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
The CIA has declined to comment on a report that the identity of the station chief in Islamabad has been exposed. By all accounts, the agency appears to be suggesting it will not bring home the chief. It was just last December that the previous station chief in Pakistan was outed and had to be recalled immediately. Experts say sour relations between the U.S. and Pakistan are the reason why this kind of activity is happening. I'm J.J. Green.
When you think of forensics, a popular TV show with crime scene investigators probably comes to mind. But have you ever thought about forensics at the 30,000-foot level? Literally. Airink has. Airink and their partners help oversee the airspace above the nation's capital and have the ability to recreate virtually any situation to indisputably determine the facts, marrying everything from voice recordings to video to GPS. Log on to ARINC.com to learn more.
Attention employees of the intelligence community and Department of Defense. Right now, you could be eligible for affordable term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by Prudential. Learn more about this important benefit for government employees at GEBA.com or call 1-800-826-1126. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102, contract series 83500.
It wasn't so long ago that collaboration was a bad word in government. Today, we know that the only way to solve our biggest challenges is for industry and government to work together to collaborate. At its upcoming Management of Change conference at the Homestead in Hot Springs, Virginia, ACT-IAC provides an ethical and trusted forum to explore solutions to our most pressing IT challenges. Be a collaborator. Register for Management of Change today at actgov.org. That's actgov.org.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Al Berman, president of Jefferson Solutions and chairman of the Procurement Roundtable, and we've been talking about the state of procurement, the acquisition workforce, and a little bit towards the end of our last segment about collaboration between industry and government. And on that theme, Al, I wondered what your thoughts when you saw Dan Gordon, current administrator for OFPP, when he issued the Mythbusters memo in terms of trying to foster better communication between industry and government during the procurement process.
And I thought he was right on in doing that. And in fact, we even wrote some notes for him on things that we thought would be areas to look at for his staff to consider when they were putting their set of 10 items together on ways to improve that relationship. And because it's really critical in any kind of procurement to have that set of good communications, good understanding on the part of each party as to what the government wants and what it is that the firm needs to do in order to successfully meet that need. So I thought, and particularly you run into issues with agencies where there tends to be uncertainties as to whether it's appropriate to say something to somebody or to have a meeting or not have a meeting. And frequently, we both know that the community tends to be risk-averse on a lot of these kinds
Absolutely.
Of things.
Contract
and so if you don't have somebody in a leadership position that goes out there and says, here, these are things that are healthy, they're good, they're useful, they help you to do a better job, and they're fine for you to do them, it's often that people are going to be reluctant to right. do it. And so by saying it's okay to have meetings, making sure that no sensitive procurement information is passed on, but letting people understand that it's of benefit to both parties to get that communications, I think that's a real plus.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that I've noticed, or I think, and I'd like to hear your observations on this, is that you know over the last 10 years or so, probably since about 2000-2001 or so, there had been a change almost in the atmospherics in the procurement system, that there was this concern that if I talk to people about my procurement, I'm going to be doing something that's inappropriate. Whereas before that, in the 90s, there was a lot of engagement in industry to try to figure out how to collaboratively improve the process. And it just seemed to me over the past decade, it ratcheted up in terms of, oh, no, I got to be so careful. And somebody's going to look over my shoulder and say, no, that's the wrong thing to do. Is your sense the same?
Yeah, you do almost see a kind of a pendulum swing in some respects. I recall back in the late 80s, early 90s, you had the procurement integrity legislation that was passed back then.
Yep.
And, of course, that was in response to a number of issues where people were providing inappropriately procurement-sensitive information to contractors, and there were a number of cases where charges were brought against people. People were sent to jail for that. And this legislation was passed, and in some respects, the legislation itself tended to be ambiguous in terms of what you could or couldn't do, and in fact, in some respects, that practically shut down the process in terms of communications. And then gradually over the 90s, that tended to change. People revised the procedures, tended to be more explicit about what you could or couldn't do. And there was this notion that there is a partnership between government and industry in trying to meet agencies' needs. Then I agree, you kind of saw it shift back again where the partnership tended to be more and more arm's length. And, you know, you were careful about what those relationships should be. So I think it again pays to have somebody in a leadership position look at it carefully and give people good, sound advice on what they can and can't do, and allow them to use that advice, but do it from the standpoint of trying to encourage communications, not right. discourage it.
I mean, I think in the goal of trying to get folks to focus on the requirements developments phase, and that communication is key. What role do you think, you know, in that communication dynamic, I'm using like buzzwords now.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. I guess I'm getting used to this.
Yeah, right.
But in that dynamic, what role do you think the program office, the communication between the contracting office, the program office and industry, how do you think that ought to work?
You know, that's a great point, because we are paying a lot of attention to the relationship between government and industry, but even within government, there are different groups in government that are performing this role. And when you look at the Defense Department, there's always been this notion of a very broad acquisition workforce that encompasses all of these different people who are program managers and project managers and people, technical folks who are defining needs and requirements, and contracting officers. Frequently, when you look at the civilian agencies, you still see people look at contracting and acquisition as, you know, in OPM parlance, 1102s and 1105s,
right.
those
classifications.
People with those classifications. And it's kind of ironic, because if you examine GAO reports or IG reports and their reviews of what makes or doesn't make a successful procurement, the problem almost invariably is at the front end. It's the requirements development process, getting the requirements right up front. And then the obvious question is, well, wait a minute, who does that? Is it the 1102s and the 1105s? No, it isn't.
It's the customer. It's the ultimate user of the stuff that's being bought, or the beneficiary of the service that's being acquired, that really writes and drives the requirements development.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And so getting them to recognize that they are playing a very important and, again, strategic role in this process, and that they are part of an acquisition workforce, even though they don't have an OPM classification defines them that
mm-hmm.
way. I think that, frankly, is one of the biggest challenges that the civilian agencies are facing. And it's a challenge to the agency overall, to agency leadership. It's also a challenge to the contracting community to help to educate customers as to their role and responsibilities in that side of the equation.
So it sounds like you think it would be a great idea if program managers responsible for implementing programs actually took some basic procurement training or, you know, introductory courses so that they have an understanding of, you know, that process and how, you know, what their role is in terms of defining, because they're defining the requirements in a certain sense defines the competition or the scope of the competition.
Sure.
Or how it's going to completely play out. It seems to me they need to have a better understanding of the procurement process in order to get better competition.
And do the planning and the market research and all of the kinds of things that come along with the front end of the process. I think that's absolutely right. It's critical for them to be understanding that that's a role that they should be playing and have to play, really, to be successful.
So, you know, just in summing up on the MythBusters program, campaign, I sort of liken to as a point in time where people begin to realize, or hopefully, like you said, the pendulum swinging, people can begin to realize, hey, it is okay to talk to industry to try to figure out the best way to solve a problem. And that does take leadership. Now, I really believe that memo in and of itself, of one thing that this administration has done so far that could potentially have the biggest impact over time is the MythBusters campaign.
No, I agree with you. I think it really is a boost. When I was procurement administrator back in the late 80s, early 90s, one of the issues that we had to deal with was to try to encourage people to look more to the commercial market to acquire things and move away from specs and that sort of thing.
I remember that.
Yeah, I mean,
I was around then too.
Yeah, I know.
I hate to date myself.
But. Makes me feel kind of old, yes. Actually. But but in looking at those sorts of issues, the one thing that really stuck with me was the notion that the more that you can have someone in a leadership role give people the confidence that these things are okay to do, and you can get the word out, because that's the other challenge. In any kind of a policy office, you can come up with all of these wonderful directives and great ideas, but if nobody reads them or they don't get down to the front line contracting people, you're out. You're not really helping people much. But in my view, the more that you can have somebody at a senior level encourage people to do these kinds of things, the more likely you're going to get good results.
Yeah, and I also think that counsel within the agencies, a procurement counsel, are key to the success of this too. They've got to buy into the idea that it's okay to talk to industry and facilitate that. I think that's also, to have that support from your internal lawyers, I think, is also critical to the success of it.
I agree. I think that's absolutely the case, because frequently it's the counsel that will be the office that says, no, you shouldn't have these conversations. You need to be careful, because you're likely to somehow provide some opportunity for somebody to get information that they shouldn't have. And then you're setting yourself up for some sort of a protest later on.
And if you think contracting officers are risk averse, lawyers can even be more risk averse. But now we have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more with Al Berman, president of Jefferson Solutions. And we've been talking about the state of procurement generally, Mythbusters campaign. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
What do successful small, medium, and large federal contractors, including two-thirds of the top 100, have in common? Membership in the Coalition for Government Procurement. Successful federal contractors know they get the information edge they need on developing acquisition trends and an effective voice to protect their interests from coalition membership. For nearly 30 years, the Coalition's been the trusted voice of industry, working with federal officials to promote common-sense procurement. Know what the best know. Join the Coalition today to protect and grow your company's business. Contact the Coalition at 202-331-0975 or visit their website at thecgp.org. That's 202-331-0975 or thecgp.org. Don't be left wondering what will happen to your federal business in 2009. Contact the Coalition today.
2014. It's more than just a legislative mandate. It's a shared goal for the many federal agencies working together to create a nationwide health information exchange. But to reach that goal takes knowledge, collaboration, and a call to action to collectively visualize the 21st century of healthcare today, not tomorrow. Hear experts discussing this subject and what we need to do to advance government healthcare and technology forward. Tune in to the Visualizing the 21st Century of Healthcare Today panel, sponsored by HIMSS, next Tuesday, May 17th at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
HIMSS invites healthcare policymakers, IT decision makers, and providers to see how influence and decisions on policy play out on the ground level. Don't miss the Government Health IT Conference and Exhibition, June 14th and 15th. Register at govhealthitconference.com for the only conference where you can share successes, challenges, and best practices with decision makers from government, industry, and the healthcare community. Go to govhealthitconference.com today.
The Ballistic Missile Defense Report is provided by Raytheon.
The United States and Romania have chosen the Devasulu Air Base in Romania as the site for a new U.S. ballistic missile defense system. The selection of the site, which will house Standard Missile 3 interceptors and an Aegis radar system, moves the U.S. closer to completion of the second phase of the President's phased adaptive approach for missile defense in Europe. In a news release, the State Department noted that SM-3 will be deployed to the new site in the 2015 timeframe.
5 million hours of experience, 19 direct hit intercepts, unmatched engineering. Raytheon Standard Missile 3 is preserving freedom at home and around the world. Now Raytheon engineers are developing the next generation SM-3. When seconds matter and there's no margin for error, Raytheon Standard Missile 3 delivers. In fact, there's nothing standard about it. Raytheon, customer success is our mission.
It's the only program of its kind in the world. A unique opportunity to help strengthen our country's defense and further your career. the National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University's School of Management. The only executive MBA degree tailored to developing leaders and managers in the U.S. defense industry. A unique combination of high-caliber executive business education, defense industry-specific knowledge, and hands-on learning designed to accelerate your career in the military, government, and corporate defense sectors. All without the career interruption of a traditional degree. Learn more at som.gmu.edu/defense. That's som.gmu.edu/defense. Do it today because the last day to apply for the fall semester is July 15th. The National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University, helping our country's defense, advancing your career.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Join me this week for my special guest, Catherine Medina, Executive Director of Rebuilding Together Alexandria, a 501c3 that helps low-income families keep their homes in good shape. The show is brought to you by Odin Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
At Equity One, they know you are more concerned than ever about outliving your money. With all the bumps in the road through your retirement years, it's vital that you map out your retirement to protect your principal and gains, minimize taxes, keep more of your Social Security check, and enable your investments to effectively fight inflation. Call Equity One today at 1-877-313-4080. That's 1-877-313-4080, and they'll help you learn how to invest your money with market gains without market risk. If you're a saver, they'll show you how to fight inflation, preserving and increasing your purchasing power without risking your savings. As you age, you can less stand the losses and lack of liquidity in the market, as life has given us less time to recover. Equity One, Inc. looks forward to hearing from you. Call Equity One today at 877-313-4080. That's 877-313-4080. Or visit Equity, the number one, INC.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Al Berman, President of Jefferson Solutions, Chairman of the Procurement Roundtable, former Administrator for Federal Procurement Policy at OMB, and also a member of the SARA panel, the Service Acquisition Reform Act panel of government contract folks who reviewed acquisition regulations, laws, statutes, policies, and made recommendations back in 2007. Al and I both were honored and privileged to be members of that panel. And in this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about those recommendations and their impact on the system to date. With that, Al, just some general thoughts, observations?
Well, I agree with you, Roger. It was a great honor to be able to serve on that panel. I thought the panel made a huge difference in terms of people looking at acquisition and understanding the importance of acquisition and carrying that message both to the administration and to the Congress. I thought Marsha Madsen and Mayor Brown did an outstanding job as chairman of that group. It was amazing, in such a disparate body, she could get us all to more or less agree on a whole bunch of things with half of the folks from industry and half of the folks from the government yeah. working on the panel, all of whom had a pretty strong background in procurement with the government at one point or another. And, you know, there seemed to be a whole host of things that came out of the panel. I do think the one area that we as a panel made a decision to focus on that wasn't really asked, we weren't really asked to do, sure, was this whole question of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in many respects, I think that the panel had its biggest effect on addressing that problem and that need that we've already talked about a little bit.
Yeah, sensitizing, you know, basically the policymakers, the appropriators, whoever on the Hill and in the executive branch to the needs of the acquisition workforce, to do an assessment, frankly, on where the acquisition workforce is or was at the time and what support did it need to grow and essentially provide best value to the taxpayer. I mean, that to me, that is one of the areas that I'm, you know, most pleased with in terms of, the dialogue, the interest, the sort of examination that the Sarah panel sort of fostered through its report, focusing on the acquisition workforce.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was most interesting, I thought, we had, I don't know, 90 different people come in and
yes.
groups come in and talk mm-hmm. to us. So we listened to a lot of people from both government and the private sector. And I thought one of the most interesting things we heard was when we had folks come in from the private sector, big companies that were interested in, quote, outsourcing. Well, outsourcing wasn't really outsourcing per se. It was actually hiring somebody to do maybe their HR or their IT work to a degree for,
yes.
for the company. But how they perceived these to be incredibly important decisions and how frequently they hired very senior people to help them go through that decision-making process and that acquisition process. I think in some respects it was eye-opening to see how much
yeah.
attention was paid to that.
The two keys to me, I mean, fundamentally, you mentioned it before, the one key is the requirements development phase. That's fundamentally sets the framework for the entire thing. It sets the framework for the competition and ultimately sets the framework for performance of the contract itself. And that is vital, and the communication between industry and government is vital. But at the same time, I think the point you're making is that, at the end of it, the sexy part is the award decision and that thing. But there's a whole next phase, and the key to real success is essentially being able to focus as well on that contract administration phase and managing the contract and doing that effectively. It's you can't sacrifice that for, putting all your research and trying to make sure you get the award. And I think my experience in government was that there's so much focus on getting that award done that lots of times, or sometimes at least, they forget about that back end and the actual contract administration phase.
And that was, as you recall, that was a conclusion of our Sarah panel report. Carl DeMeo and I were co-chairs doing the performance-based
mm-hmm.
piece of that report, and we talked to an awful lot of people, and one of the things we heard from a lot of folks was one of the complications in doing this was there was so much focus on getting to award that was hard to look at the end of the process where
right.
people were actually out there performing the work. And if you look at a performance-based services contract, you're asking to identify the results you want and then be able to measure whether you're getting them. Well, if you don't do the measurement part of the equation, then
right.
you don't have much. And so
right.
it even in the services contracting side, that becomes critical. Now, I know Carl DeMeo is out in San Diego now, I think, trying to straighten out the city of San Diego and all of its various procurement
well,
other sorts of areas.
Itself.
So,
I thought you were going to say he's trying to straighten out the state of California.
Well,
that
I
would
don't
be,
know.
I don't know if that can be done
I
or not.
I think he's taking things a bite at a time.
Okay.
But anyway.
Yeah,
but,
that makes sense,
but
right?
Carl is doing,
modular approach,
Carl,
right?
Right. Carl, that's right. It's sort of a part of the new 25 points.
I right. Guess. Exactly. Exactly.
But Carl is doing a fine job out there. One of the things, though, that we found back to the Sarah panel was there was, of course, a lot of interest in having people shift to a performance-based mode because
mm-hmm.
you're looking for ways to really get good results. And this
sure.
is one way to do it. But we did our own little review of the information that was being sent in from agencies about performance-based contracts. And I think our conclusion was that less than half were truly performance-based.
Yes, yeah.
And so even there, you have the issues of ensuring people understand how to do it and what to
right.
do. And kind of coming back to an earlier...
Okay, I'll hold that thought
okay.
for when we come back. But right now, we have to take a break. When we return, we'll be talking more with Al Berman, President, Jefferson Solutions. And we're talking about the Sarah Panel Report, performance, a little bit about performance-based contracting. And when we come back from the break, one of the things I'm going to be asking Al is, if there's one thing you could do to change the system, what would that be? You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Throughout the history of American defense, Northrop Grumman has helped give the men and women of our military an edge with innovative design. Northrop Grumman delivered the products and systems that changed the course of battles and of wars. Today, our technology makes a difference in every domain: air, land, sea, space, and cyberspace. The people of Northrop Grumman build satellites, unmanned systems, electronic systems, information technology, as well as submarines and ships. We build the systems that give our troops a moment-by-moment picture of the battle space and a critical war-fighting advantage, along with shields from enemy threats. For 70 years, wherever the American military has served, Northrop Grumman has supported our nation's and our allies' defenses with the most advanced technology. Northrop Grumman, defining the future.
With vacation time just around the corner, are you ready to go? Ackerman Security can help keep families like yours safe and secure. For just $18.95 a month, trust in the protection of Ackerman's nationally certified monitoring center. And switch your existing system to Ackerman at no cost and get a great $18.95 rate. Ackerman is the only company with a guaranteed response time. You want fast response, you want Ackerman. Get 3 months of monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070 or AckermanSecurity.com.
The Federal Drive is every weekday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Hear interviews, news, perspective, and analysis from Tom Temin and Amy Morris. The Federal Drive team will help give you the important information you need about the federal government and how it impacts your organization or agency. Tune in 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. or go to FederalNewsRadio.com. The Federal Drive is sponsored by CDWG. CDWG, the people who get it.
There's no better way to study the world's best golf swings than to watch them side by side on the range. Move down the line from Arnold Palmer to Fred Couples to Phil Mickelson, and you notice not just the differences, but the similarities, like their wonderful balance, rhythm, and timing. And if you look closely as they leave, you'll notice something else they have in common, the same timepiece. A Rolex Day-Date. Available in 18-karat white or yellow gold or platinum, the Day-Date is put through 15 days and nights of the most grueling testing before it ever leaves Geneva. That ensures that, like these great golfers, it will perform as well in the real world as it does in practice. To see a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
The Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program open season is here. Visit ltcfeds.com to find out who is eligible to apply with abbreviated underwriting. Long-term care is expensive and is not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. With benefits designed specifically for the federal family, the FeltZip offers a smart way to help protect your lifestyle and remain independent should you need long-term care services someday. Start planning for the future. Visit ltcfeds.com.
The website of the week is the Google Transparency Report. Now, this site includes an interactive map, so you can click on different countries. The Chinese officials consider censorship demands to be state secrets, so we cannot disclose that information at this time. This can show traffic patterns. If a country blocks internet access, you can immediately see this. You can see if any countries are blocking internet traffic. The Google Transparency Report.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
From text messages to apps, games and email, the mobile internet is becoming a bigger part of our lives every day. And whether we live in the city or on the open countryside, all Americans should benefit from mobile internet investment. That's why Light Squared is investing in the first nationwide wholesale-only 4G LTE mobile broadband network, complemented by coast-to-coast satellite coverage. By partnering with wireless service providers, retailers, and device manufacturers, LightSquared is making seamless, ultra-fast mobile broadband a reality for every American. Send an email from the Grand Canyon. Download movies in minutes while on the go. Make calls hundreds of miles from the nearest cell tower. It's all possible with the LightSquared network. LightSquared, lighting the way to a wireless broadband revolution. Learn how LightSquared is creating jobs, encouraging innovation, and investing in vital American infrastructure at LightSquared.com.
Do you want to know how to manage stress, do more with less?
Work well with your political boss? Protect your professional liability? If you're a senior executive or an SES candidate, you can't afford to miss Managing Smarter, the Senior Executives Association annual conference. Join former Representative Tom Davis, political pundit Norm Ornstein, and other speakers on June 16th at the Grand Hyatt Washington. For a complete agenda and to register, visit the SEA website, www.seniorexecs.org.
Connect with Federal News Radio wherever you are. Like us on Facebook to see the hottest news stories on your wall. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio. Download our free iPhone app. Just go to the App Store and search for Federal News Radio. And now, connect to the radio station straight from your cell phone. Just call 712-432-6616. Go to federalnewsradio.com and search for social media for details.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Al Berman, and we've been talking about just a whole host of various procurement topics and issues. And when we were taking a break, Al, you were talking a little bit about performance-based contracting.
Right, Roger. And the point that I was making was it is, again, critical for the program people and the contracting people to be able to collaborate, because if you don't have the program folks who are, in fact, performing that measurement or recognize that that's a critical role for them to play in the process, or being willing to spend the time up front to develop a performance-based statement of work, which takes some time and effort to do and requires some brainstorming on performance measures and things. It's not something you can just kind of develop overnight. That becomes critical to the success of the effort.
And just a follow-up on that, you know, I wonder, you know, because you don't hear a lot of talk about it right now and from this administration in terms of performance base, a focus on it. And I'm just wondering, there's so much focus, like the DoD Better Buying Initiative, on we're going to do firm fixed price contracts whenever possible, or do cost reimbursement, kind of that sort of approach. That sort of, it seems to me, that sort of makes it more difficult to do performance-based from their perspective, potentially, right? Because if you're doing firm fixed price, hey, you've got a statement of work that people can intelligently bid against. And if you're doing cost reimbursement, that's where the uncertainties and the risks shifts to the government to reimburse based on costs.
But in both cases, you can identify what are the performance measures that you're looking for and that you're going to incentivize. Mm-hmm. And so you're still looking to get, particularly in a fixed price contract, you're looking to get a result. And basically, the contractor is accepting the risk of being able to perform and get that result for you. So it certainly lends itself very effectively to a performance-based approach, cost reimbursement kind of contract with an incentive approach. Again, you can identify what are you trying to incentivize and then see whether you've achieved that. So in both of those cases, you are looking for ways still to keep the contractor focused on the business outcomes you're looking for.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think of this? Is one of my sort of pet peeves or views is that when anybody, and I think ought to happen, and it's not clearly articulated in the regulations right now, but it seems to me that if you're going to create, you know, an enterprise-wide contract that covers an agency or some sort of cross-cutting multi-agency contract or a government-wide contract, one of the things your business case has to address, and I think it needs to be more forcefully said in regulation, whether it's a FAR or wherever, is that you've got to document and explain why current existing contracts won't meet your needs if you're going to go create something else, because that costs government money in its management of that procurement process, and it costs industry, you know, bid and proposal costs, and there's a limited pool of those.
Right, and you don't want to have a whole bunch of empty market baskets, which is what you end up having if there are too many of these things and nobody gets anything out of them. I agree with you on that. I think it's important to be able to ask people to look to see what's there already and to make a good business judgment that this is something that's necessary, that has to be done, that can already be done with existing capabilities and resources. In fact, one of the problems, as you recall from the panel when we were looking at this whole issue, was nobody even really knew how many there were or where they were. I mean, you didn't even have a
very frustrating
decent accounting of what was there. And so the question of going ahead and doing your due diligence, you couldn't really do it because you didn't know what to be looking at.
Yeah. So we only have a few minutes left, and I'm just going to shoot some questions at you and see what
sure.
you think. And you know, first one is, you know, there's been headlines now this week about recommendations that DoD ought to rethink its acquisition workforce. You know, the idea being that, you know, they typically have officers or, you know, servicemen rotate through in positions, in important management positions in the procurement process, and whether that's an effective way, because they're not, quote, procurement professionals, and they're put in a position for a couple years, then they rotate out. And, you know, the recommendation is that, you know, I think I know what you're going to say, but the recommendation is, hey, to improve this process, you ought to make it a core, you know, sort of area of professional development, and essentially have a core to dedicated mm-hmm. to that, and a professional ability to advance professionally through an acquisition workforce, like, or acquisition function type approach for officers or whatever.
Well,
and I was inarticulate, and I had a problem with it, but you question.
No, but I think it makes great sense to recognize this as a critical role, and I think the services do recognize it. I know that there were a number of changes in the Army to do precisely those kinds of things, to give greater recognition to the importance of this role, and to, in fact, put senior officers in positions of power there, as also giving recognition to the importance of acquisition.
Okay, and just another question I'd like to ask folks is, if you could make one change in the procurement system that you think would be, you know, the biggest benefit sort of collectively, ultimately for the taxpayer, because the system is designed to provide goods and services for agencies to meet their missions, and ultimately, you know, that's a return on investment for the taxpayer. What one change would you think would be most beneficial to the system as a whole?
I don't think there's any mechanical change or change in terms of how people do their buying. My view on government is government works best when it has good leaders, and those leaders recognize the importance of what their agency is doing. And so one of the things that I've always felt was that the more that people with these kinds of skill sets who understand how government works from a contracting standpoint, but the more they also are politically savvy, in effect a chief acquisition officer, the more that that individual can be given a seat at the table at the highest levels of the agency, the more likely you are to get a good result.
And I think, you know, and I guess so, I'll give you my two cents on that. I think one of the biggest things that would benefit the system, frankly, has already been done. And I really believe that the Mythbusters campaign and that dynamic, I hope, and I'm an optimist, I think that will have a fundamental sort of change in the whole atmospherics of the procurement system. And when you talk about that leadership and the importance of having good leaders, Dan Gordon and the issuance of that, I think, is such an important step in terms of sort of, again, changing the mood of the procurement system in a certain sense, and saying it's okay to talk to industry to try to figure out the best way to solve these problems. For my two cents, that's, you know, I think it sort of hits on yours too, because it takes a good leader to have the, you know, the vision to be able to take a look at the problem and say, this is one way that I can provide that leadership. So that's my thought on it.
I agree with you on that, Roger. And I was thinking of Jack Gantzler doing his report on Army, you know, and Jack's a procurement roundtable member. Dave Berteau was on that group, and they basically came to those conclusions about leadership as well being critical to making this job work effectively.
Well, Al, you know, I really enjoyed our discussion today. Thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. This is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Roger Waldron. Have a great day out there.
Thanks very much, Roger.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.